And you should all be seeing the first slide of my presentation, which says RTB official, reasons.org, and just indicates all the ways that you can contact us through social media. If you're not aware, Reasons to Believe does have a 24/7 YouTube channel, and we post up there virtually every day. So with that, let's get into the topic on human origins. And if you want to go into this subject in depth, Fuzz and I wrote a 400-page book called Who is Adam? It's now in its second edition, and you can get a free chapter of that book by going to reasons.org/Rana. And in terms of human exceptionalism, I've written several chapters on that in this book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. And so you can get a free chapter of that book by going to reasons.org/Ross. In that book, I make a distinction between the exceptionalism of the nephesh animals, the soulish animals, birds, mammals, and a few of the higher reptilian species, and all other life, but also the exceptional features of human beings relative to these exceptional soulish creatures. That's in Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. We'll cover a little bit of that. And for those of you who really want to get into the technical details of human origins in terms of the latest debates that are going on with theistic evolutionists and atheists, we at Reasons to Believe sponsored an all-day conference a few weeks ago where we invited top human origin scholars who are atheists and theistic evolutionists to engage us with our biblical model on human origins. And you can access that by going to reasons.org/human origins workshop 2020, and that'll pop up the video recordings of that day's workshop. So, but again, it's a little on the technical side, but it's a great way. I mean, you can actually see us engaging top atheists and theistic evolutionary scholars and Christians who hold different views than we do. But in this part one, I'm going to really focus on human exceptionalism. And so I've used this slide a few times, basically making the point that there are models out there that say we're descended from a primitive bipedal primate species. And feel free to express whatever sports bias you want with a creature on the extreme web. When I'm in Canada, I put a hockey player there instead of a football player. Japan, a sumo wrestler, I mean, you can figure it out. But this is really the debate that's going on. It's why I'm doing this series, is because there is a major debate going on in academia about whether or not we human beings are simply the product of naturalistic evolution from a common ancestor with the chimpanzees, or are we a special creation? And a huge part of the debate is whether or not we humans really are exceptional, or do we just simply differ by degree with, say, other primates that are on the planet now, or those that have existed previously. So that's what we're going to be looking at. And I'm going to first share with you some of the evidences that are in the scientific literature for why we humans are exceptional amongst all other life forms here on planet Earth. And not just the present life forms, but the past life forms. Because, yeah, a major part of the debate is people are trying to claim, for example, that the Neanderthals, Homo erectus, are just as human as we are, or that we're just simply a more advanced development of these creatures that preceded us. But one of the things that I've written about in Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, and my colleague Fazal Rana has written several update articles making the point that we humans have a unique capacity for symbolic expression. Now, I don't think we've made enough. The problem is within certain circles of naturalistic research, they've been claiming that animals have symbolic capability because they can mimic our words. For example, you can get a parrot to mimic our words. You can get dogs and cats, and I think there was one gorilla that developed a vocabulary of about 200 words. The footnote to that, though, is it took a couple of decades of training for that need to get there. But when I'm talking about capacity for symbolic expression, what I'm meaning here is the ability to develop a number system, an alphabet, and to use that number system to do mathematics, the alphabet to produce literature. And so this is something that really is unique to human beings, our ability to compose paragraphs and chapters and books, and to be able to take numbers and the symbolic symbols and mathematics and actually solve problems mathematically. This is something that is unique to human beings. Moreover, we see that this basically comes about very quickly. I mean, in the 21st century, what we've noticed is you can put an iPad in front of a child that's 9 months old, and they're able to actually symbolically engage with that device. You put that in front of a chimpanzee, and the chimpanzee just thinks the thing is a toy, throws it at the wall or whatever, or will hit a button and be entertained by what's there. I mean, yeah, I got a cat, for example, that likes to watch television. But that's different from symbolic expression. And it's different from, for example, you see a hen making scratches in the dirt, and people say that's symbolic expression. It's not the same as developing a number system to be able to do mathematics or to be able to compose a paragraph. Matter of fact, if you just look at the street signs we have, I mean, these are really simple symbols. A stop sign or a yield sign or a railway crossing sign. I mean, we humans immediately figure out what that means. But it's not possible to train a non-human animal to determine what those very simple symbols are and how to respond accordingly. Likewise, you can train a horse, for example, to stomp its feet for 2 + 2 = 4. Although research is showing that the horse is simply looking at the human, and when the human smiles, they figure that must be the time for me to stop. So years ago, decades ago, they used to think that dogs and horses could actually count and do things like 2 + 3 = 5. But they found out that when there is no human bond with that animal, they were totally incapable of being able to do that. Likewise, they're totally incapable of figuring out how to respond to something as simple as a stop sign at a street crossing. And there's a number of articles that have been published on this. I cite several in Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, where you got people basically saying that this is where humans indeed are unique in a fundamentally different way from all their life here on planet Earth. And this is coming from people who are not theists. They're now acknowledging this. Number two is the ability to invent and manipulate symbols. This is beyond just symbolic expression. It's the ability to invent symbols and to use those symbols in a useful way to solve problems or to communicate. So again, we can invent an alphabet, but also use that alphabet to compose words and the paragraphs and the pages and the books. And this is something that dates back. I mean, people thought this evolved in the human species. We now know that's not true, that even the most primitive peoples thousands of years ago, even more than 10,000 years ago, were doing this. One paper that got published that's basically making this point is that we now see that the Haida Indians in the Queen Charlotte Islands 10,500 years ago were crafting symbols on their totem poles that documented the rapid rise of sea level at the end of the last ice age. The totem pole record is still there showing that they were actually responding to their observations of a 300-foot rise in the seas as a result of the melting of ice left over from the last ice age. And that probably could have dated back even earlier than that. Okay, moving on, the ability to invent and manufacture complex tools. This has been a major debate in the scientific literature. For example, what you'll see if you go to that workshop is that there was one Christian who was making a big deal about the fact that you see bipedal primates a 500,000 years ago using javelins to hunt, and how the javelin was as advanced as an Olympic javelin. But the whole point is it's still a single piece of wood. It's basically a spear. It's not a complex tool. It's simply a sharpened piece of wood. And for example, we see chimpanzees using similar spears to hunt bush babies. That goes on to this day. And therefore, I would argue what we saw in this find of a javelin-like spear that dates a 500,000 years old really isn't that much different from the kinds of short spears that chimpanzees use. And we notice with chimpanzees, they basically break off branches from trees and find one that makes a good spear, and they quickly figure out which one is more effective in being able to make a kill. So I'm not at all impressed that 500,000 years ago there was a bipedal primate that was able to determine, hey, this is much better for making me successful in hunting than these other pieces of wood. And I could easily see how you would find something that would very closely mimic a javelin that's used in the Olympics to this day. What we mean by complex tools, this is what's unique to human beings, is being able to fashion a piece of wood with a shaped stone, a shaped piece of wood with a shaped stone with sinews and some kind of natural glue or wax to make a shovel, an axe. And so what you see with the tools of the bipedal primates is similar to what you see with chimpanzees and orangutans, where they take a single rock, they'll chip the rock to make it more effective, but it's still just a single shaped rock. It's not combined with a shaped piece of wood and a sinew to make an axe. Okay, I've been asked to remind everybody to make sure that you mute your microphone, because we are picking up background noise, which everyone is hearing. And so in the lower left, if you're using a computer or an iPad, you'll see a little microphone button, and you can mute that, and that will cut out the background noise. But if you do have a question, you are welcome to interrupt me if you're not following what I'm saying. I'm kind of pleased that no one's interrupting. That means you're all following. But yeah, this is the third point. It's the ability to invent, manufacture complex tools. And what you see with human beings, they'll be able to figure out how they can take a piece of ivory and carve it, and you'll combine that with a piece of wood and some stone and make a complex tool. What we see is very quickly, these tools become more and more refined. Whereas what we notice, for example, the Neanderthals, they have been here on planet Earth a whole lot longer than us human beings, almost 200,000 years. And yet we see the tools at the end of their period of existence here on Earth is indistinguishable from the tools at the beginning. We don't see any evidence for technological advance. What we do see with humans is that once the climate stabilizes enough where people can produce an excess of food and therefore set apart some of the human labor for something other than just simply trying to come up with enough food, you see a very rapid advance in technology. The technology is simply limited by the climate stability, where the climate is extremely unstable like it was during most of the last ice age. You don't see much technological advance, but you'll see some papers, articles I put at reasons.org. If you simply search under bread making, three times during the last ice age, you see very advanced bread making technology, but it happened during those brief episodes during the last ice age, where the climate became stable enough, where humans were able to set aside labor from other than just coming up with enough food for the day. And when that happens, you see them building sophisticated hearths, you see them building tools for grinding the grain, roasting the grain, and then turning that ground roasted grain into bakery products. That happened three times during the last ice age. And of course, once the climate became permanently stable, like it did 11,000 years ago, you see an explosion of inventiveness and manufacturing complexity. And that has continued to this day. We call that the Neolithic Revolution. Okay, point four, I've already covered that. Capacity for explosive technological advance, only limited by the climate optimal climate and climate stability. Number five is the ability to manufacture and wear clothes. Now, often you'll see in web articles, Homo erectus and Neanderthals and the Denisovans, they'll show them with these furs on. But the truth is, we have zero evidence that any creature besides human beings ever wore clothes. Now, of course, I'm accepting the dogs that we decorate with clothes today. Animals that are closely bonded to humans, like horses and cows, they will tolerate clothing, but they won't manufacture clothing. The manufacture of clothing is unique to human beings. We see no evidence in the Neanderthal Denisovan artifacts, for example, that they had needles where they could sew clothes. That's unique to human beings. And even the earliest human artifacts, we see that they had the implements for cutting furs and sewing furs together for making sophisticated clothing. And you'll see a little later why this was essential. What you notice with the bipedal primates that preceded us is that they had a body structure and hair or fur that was able to keep them warm when it got cold. We humans are anatomically not designed for cold weather or a cold climate. But because we are endowed with this huge parietal lobe and hand dexterity, we were able to manufacture and wear clothes. And the earliest humans were doing that. They were manufacturing and wearing clothes. Matter of fact, you see that in the early chapters of Genesis, that Adam and Eve and their sons were wearing clothes right from the get-go. And so immediately we had that capacity to do that. Number six is the ability to invent and use complex languages. You heard me say earlier that we see with some birds, for example, and some apes, is that they can mimic our words, but they're not able to put together words to form a grammatical sentence, for example. I had a pet parrot, and other people have had parrots, and if you just repeat a sentence to them often enough, they'll repeat it back to you, but they're not able to invent a sentence on their own. They simply are able to repeat, and that can only happen when they're in a long, emotionally bonded relationship with a human being. So unique to us is the ability to put words together, to communicate a sentence or a paragraph. And we have the capacity not to develop just one language, but multiple languages. For example, years ago, I knew a Bible scholar who was fluent in 27 languages. And he would teach Greek and Hebrew all over the world, but teach it in the native language of the people there. But I was with him in a car one time. This was Gleason Archer, where he told me he was going to be spending a summer, and he was going to start a summer in Portugal, teaching a course on Greek and Hebrew. He was going to teach it in Portuguese and go to Spain and teach it in Spanish. He was going to go to Italy and teach it in Italian, and go to France and teach it in French, and then go on to Germany and Czechoslovakia. In each nation, he taught it in their native language, and they all thought he was a native speaker. I asked him how he did that. He says, well, I take my devotions in a different language every day. And he was also fluent in a lot of languages that have long disappeared, like Biblical Greek and the Semitic languages that were in use, like Aramaic. And so this is something we humans can do. Not a lot of Americans are fluent in two or more languages, but notice this. How many of us are fluent in multiple computer languages? That's a language as well. And so I may not be bilingual. I was bilingual. I'm not anymore because I don't practice it, but I do know multiple computer languages. But again, no non-human animal is capable of doing anything like this. And the list goes on. A capacity to form complex social structures. What we see with animals, the advanced animals, the soulish animals, is that they're able to form social groups. So you got a family or an extended family or a tribe, but they're not able to do what we humans are capable of doing, not only forming a family group and then an extended family structure, but a village and then a town, a city, and a nation, and where we're able to communicate with different social groups. I mean, typically you'll see chimpanzees, for example, one family group will compete with another family group, have a little mini war going on. But what you don't see are these complex social groups engaging one another to their mutual benefit with trade and so forth. This is unique to human beings. We alone build these complex towns and cities and then communicate with other towns and cities. And number eight is the ability to invent and use complex trading and transportation systems. And so humans quickly figure out that they're more efficient if they specialize. And so once again, when the climate becomes stable enough, you immediately see specialization where people will focus on raising food. Others will focus on art or music or engineering or science or trading. And the trading is the one thing you see as soon as you have a modicum of climate stability. You get the springing up of villages and towns where the different villages and towns will specialize because it's more efficient, more productive that way, and they begin to trade with one another. And what you see is they are able to fashion boats and build roads and vehicles that they can move goods across. This is unique to human beings. We don't see non-human animals building carts or ships and specializing and trading with one another. And so, for example, with the higher apes on the planet today, and also with the bipedal primates that preceded us, they're all doing the same thing. You don't see them forming social groups where they just focus on one part of their existence and trade with others to get the other products that they need. Now, this is something you see in the Neolithic Revolution, where you have an entire town of people where all the inhabitants are focused on making pottery goods and then trading those pottery goods for grains and vegetables and meat. And other communities will focus just on animal husbandry and using the milk and meat to trade for the pottery products, or another town where all the focus is on making tools. So again, the specialization and this complex trading is unique to human beings. The ability to engage in mathematics, literature, philosophy, and theology. And there's been articles published in the scientific literature where anthropologists have tried to claim that Neanderthals and Denisovans, for example, were engaged in philosophy and theology. And that's usually based on the fact that they'll say, well, we see this skeleton that's in the ground. It looks like it's been buried. And 20, 30 feet away, we see some flower pollen. And so we think that they were holding a funeral service for this individual that died. And they interpret that as an expression of theology, as a belief in a life after death. But that could just simply be wishful thinking. These papers all have been disputed in terms of the claims that they're making. It could be that the flower pollens are there by accident, or it could be that this is an expression of grief. And I think this is significant. In Christianity, we believe not only in human exceptionalism, but nephesh exceptionalism, the exceptionalism of the nephesh animals. And these nephesh animals have been endowed by God with mind, will, and emotions. They're capable of forming strong, emotionally bonded relationships with one another. Every species of life where the parents will sacrifice to care for the young and show an emotional bond with their offspring is in this category of being a nephesh animal. And therefore, when an individual dies, there is a grief process that goes on. And I would argue that this published claim that Neanderthals were engaged in theology is simply an expression of the soulishness that these creatures had. They were soulish animals, and hence they had these strong emotional bonds. When that bond is broken, they go through a period of grief. And we actually see this with non-human animals on the planet today. So for example, you have elephants. They're intelligent creatures, and they form these social groups where you've got a matriarch elephant, and there will be several females with their offspring that will work together with a matriarch elephant. But what zoologists have observed is that when the matriarch elephant dies, all the other members of that social group will march around the dead matriarch elephant and pile hay over her until her body is completely covered. And we don't interpret that as an expression of philosophy, theology. We interpret that as an expression of an emotional loss and grief. And I think a lot of us have seen this in our pets. I mean, in our household, we had a dog and a cat, and that dog and cat bonded to one another. But by the way, where you do see soulish animals of different species bonding to one another, it's always because each of them is bonded to a human being. It takes a higher being to make that possible. But yeah, our cat was strongly emotionally bonded to the dog. And when the dog passed, that cat went through a period of mourning that lasted about 40 days. And so these soulish animals can experience that. But again, if we go to mathematics and literature, there's no question. We have zero evidence that non-human animals, including Neanderthals, were capable of expressing mathematics or developing literature, being able to write down stories and communicate that to one another. And then I think this is the last one here, the ability to tame, domesticate, and train the nephesh animals. And it tells us in the Bible, in the book of Job in particular, that it takes a higher being to tame a nephesh animal. In fact, when God was speaking to Job and his friends, it says, you've been able to tame every one of these species. And it says, notice, some are easy to tame, some are difficult to tame, but you've been able to tame them all. And what he meant by taming is that we're able to train these animals to do things for us that don't provide any benefit for the individual animal. And, you know, it's one thing to train an ant to go fetch food that they eat, because you know they get in a benefit. We're not really taming them; we're simply giving them what they want. But with the nephesh animals, we're actually able to train a horse or a cow or a dog or a cat to do things, to serve us in a way that it's actually a sacrifice for the animal to serve us. But they do it because they have a bonded relationship with us. But notice they don't tame one another.
I have a question.
It takes a higher being to do that. You had a question, Doug?
Yeah. Is this ability that we have, would you consider that a symbiotic relationship? Because I would imagine that naturalists would say that's just a symbiotic thing that we have between animals and us. It's just fine-tuned or something. But the fine-tuning, I guess, is significant, too.
Well, that argument has been made that the animal benefits, we benefit, and this is really no big deal. But I think what I'm pointing out here, this is a unique feature of human beings, is that we're able to take these wild animals and tame them where they have a bonded relationship with us, where they desire to be with us, and they express a desire to please us and to serve us. And they don't do this with one another. This is unique to what we do to human beings. And if you go to the end of the book of Job, chapter 42, it says, notice it takes a higher being to train and domesticate and tame these animals. Likewise, it takes a higher being to tame the human being. And basically made the point that, you know, no human being can humble a proud human heart. It takes God to do that. And God basically said, Job came to me to be tamed by me. The rest of you did not. So I'm going to have my servant Job pray for you that you'll submit in such a way that you can be trained. And so, and we're talking about the ability to tame and train is we're actually have the capacity to train these animals to do things that they could never do in the wild. And so this is another principle we see, is that when these animals are emotionally bonded to a higher being, they're able to do things that they could never do in the wild. Incidentally, the same thing's true as human beings, that when we're emotionally bonded to God and are trained by God, we're able to do things that we could never do when we were not submitted and trained by God. The same principle applies. But again, this is a feature of human exceptionalism, is that we alone of all life forms on planet Earth are able to do this to creatures that are not part of our species. Actually have them come into an emotional relationship with us, where they can serve and please us in a way where they're actually doing things that they would never do in the wild, and literally sacrificing to do things. I mean, it's been noticed in war, for example, that dogs and horses will literally sacrifice their life in order to preserve the life of a human being to whom they're bonded to. And so this is more than just a tit for tat that Doug was raising, is it goes beyond tit for tat, and that's actually been pointed out in the scientific literature. Okay, I thought I was going to get a little farther than this. I've actually gone 30 minutes, so I'm going to stop here. And what I'm going to be doing next week when we get together is look at the exceptional morphological features of us human beings. We have a body unlike any other body on planet Earth. I mean, you look at all the animals on planet Earth, they have similar features. And people will say, well, we're just an advanced ape. But if you look at our morphology and our genes, we have things that none of the other apes have by a huge stretch. So I'll get into that next week, just the exceptional morphology that we have. And also we'll be getting into how we're able to use that morphology in such a way to express the exceptionalism that we've been seeing here. So with that, I'm gonna stop and then I'm gonna take questions. And during the Q&A time, feel free bring up any question you want. Another part of this series is we're actually going to be looking in detail at what the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, and Homo erectines were able to do, and contrast that with human beings and actually dig into the debate. And we'll get into a little bit of the genetics debate, because there's been a huge genetics debate going on about whether or not we're really exceptional. What is astounding to me in the 21st century, we actually have a large number of scientists trying to claim that there's nothing exceptional about human beings at all. And that's why I decided to spend some focus on this particular series. So let me exit this and let me see how I can make that happen. Yes, here we go. And let's get back here. Okay, now I can see all of you, and look at all the chats that are going up there. Wow. And there's so much on the chat feature there. I'm not going to have time to read it all, but there's a way you can put your hand up. So there's a little feature there where you can raise your hand. And if you do that, then I'll address you. Otherwise, feel free to ask a question on any topic. I see you, Yevendran. So just unmute your microphone and talk, and everybody will be able to hear you.
So the question that I have is that, is there any biblical verses that show or teach us that there are nefesh exceptionalism?
Yes, in the sense that you see the word bara used in Genesis chapter 1 for God creating the birds and the sea mammals. And that word in Genesis 1 means creating something brand new that never existed before. You see that word bara used three times in Genesis 1. The first time when God creates the physical universe. It's not used again until creation day 5, when God creates these sea mammals and birds. Basically making the point there's something fundamentally distinct about these sea mammals and birds that never existed before on the earth. And basically making the point they have a non-physical component. So up until creation day 5, everything that God created was purely physical. But now in creation day five, we got creatures that are more than just physical beings. They're physical and soulish. The third and last time you see the word bara is in creation day six, when God creates human beings, basically making the point there's something fundamentally different that never existed before in human beings, making the point that we're not just an advanced nephesh creature, we are fundamentally different. And so what you're seeing is that, you know, we've got life that's physical and soulish, and one and only one species here on Earth that's physical, soulish, and spiritual. Or what you see in the book of Job is that these animals are able to form relationships and serve and please a higher species, namely as human beings. So that's what their soul allows them to do, is connect with us human beings. And likewise, we humans have a spirit that allows us to discover God and form a relationship with God. So I would go to the book of Job and the Genesis making that point. But it's those points that are being challenged by a number of non-theistic anthropologists today. And I see you got your hand raised, Ross, so go for it.
Yeah, it always seemed to me that another thing that makes human beings exceptional is the ability for technology and knowledge to advance from generation to generation. Would you include that in your list?
I would. I should have emphasized that. And that's actually something that's going to come up when we look at the morphology of human beings, that we are designed to be highly functional for many decades, which means, for example, that your grandfather can pass on the technology that he's been able to develop to you, and then you can pass it on to your son and your grandson. But that means we live long enough so that we humans can form communities where we got three or four generations. And so, you know, we hear in science, for example, we stand on the shoulders of giants, which means that we take advantage of all the knowledge, education, and technology of the scientists that lived before us. And we stand on their shoulders and we advance it to a higher level. And so the students that we train at the different universities can take advantage of the advances that we've made and continue the advance. But yeah, that's an important point. There's generational advance that we can bring about. But I think what we see here in the 21st century, it's not just generational advance, is that we actually see it over just a passage of a few years. There are scientific disciplines, for example, where the knowledge base doubles every 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
You know, this clearly is unique to human beings to have this capacity for extremely rapid advance in knowledge. I mean, if you look at elephants, for example, they live long enough to have, you know, several generations. But what you see is this matriarch mother passes on her elephant knowledge to her children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, but you don't see in advance that knowledge simply gets passed on and kept from generation to generation. So that's how the elephants remember all the water holes are. The matriarch elephant basically trains the females on how to find all that stuff, but you don't see advance like you do with human beings. So good point. Thanks. Okay, I see a hand from Doug. Go for it, Doug.
Let me see if I can remember my question. You have a wide, this is one thing that's unique about you, is you know a lot of stuff about all different branches of science. And so one thing that bothered me about this Nevesh thing is I hear atheists talk about how there's evidence that birds and reptiles are related, but yet reptiles don't seem to have any kind of a nephesh relationship between humans and themselves. So how would you respond to that? That's my question.
Well, that's a whole nother subject. As a matter of fact, I'm going to try to talk my colleague, Faisal Rana, into doing a little mini series for us here in Paradoxes on this whole question, did birds evolve from reptiles? And are birds just simply advanced reptiles? I mean, if you look at birds and reptiles, they both have scales. And, you know, there's some debate today about whether there were dinosaurs that had feathers. And so, and that's kind of what you see in the scientific literature, that the birds naturally evolved from dinosaurs. But I'm going to be encouraging Fuzz to do in this talk is basically make the point, if you actually look in detail at the anatomy, the morphology of a bird and compare them with a reptile, there are enormous differences. The birds are uniquely designed for flight. You know, they got these hollow bones, they got a very light weight, and they're able to take in oxygen when they're breathing in as well as breathing out. Because after all, if you're going to be flying through the air, you've got to maintain continual high metabolic rate. So their internal organs are radically different. I think you can understand. If you just look at the outer appearance, you actually have these two-legged reptiles that hop around. They have scales, and you got two-legged birds that hop around. They have scales. So outwardly, they have similarities. I think this is true of all life here on planet Earth, is that, you know, God repeats optimal designs. So we shouldn't be surprised from a biblical creation perspective that reptiles, for example, have a lot of shared features with birds, but it's the unique features which tell us they can't be the product of naturalistic evolution. But I'm going to let Fuzz address that because that's really his specialty more than it is mine.
Well, just one final comment about that. They point to the fact that there are flying reptiles. And, you know, they say that certain types of dinosaurs evolved into birds. And
You see that with mammals as well, Doug. I mean, you got flying squirrels. You got these bats. You have, these reptiles that flew tens of billions of years ago. But what you see is that they're basically gliding. What's unique to these birds is they're able to be on the ground and literally immediately hop, start flapping their wings, and be able to fly long distances and to be able to sustain that kind of flight. I mean, you've got birds that can fly for 8,000 miles. So there's a big difference between, say, watching what a sparrow does and what a flying squirrel does. Okay, if any of you wants to ask a question, all you need to do is unmute your mic. If you put your hand up, I'll try to recognize you, but all you need to do is unmute your mic. And I think I do see one hand up. Yes, Ross has got his hand up. Go for it.
Yeah. Hugh, how would you respond to theistic evolutionists and secular evolutionists who say that the evidence for universal common ancestor is overwhelming from a whole lot of different points of view of studying biology?
Good question. And they predominantly try to sustain the argument for common descent by looking at the genes. And they basically argue that, for example, the modern apes and humans, they have shared deleterious mutations. And they said that can only be explained if they're descended from a common ancestor. I'm going to be getting into some of that in the weeks that follow, and I'm going to be basically arguing that what they identify as a shared deleterious mutation, in fact, is a shared beneficial mutation. Probably the most famous example of that, one that we've debated extensively with our friends of BioLogos, is the vitamin C issue. We humans cannot manufacture vitamin C. And so the claim is that's because a common ancestor to the chimps and the humans had a mutation where that ancestor lost its ability to manufacture vitamin C. And so that's why chimpanzees and gorillas and orangutans and humans aren't able to manufacture vitamin C. What they're overlooking is there's a big advantage to us not being able to manufacture vitamin C. I mean, those animals on the planet that do manufacture their own vitamin C, and the vast majority of animals do, they're able to manufacture their own vitamin C. It's a far simpler morphological mechanism to manufacture the vitamin C than the system you see in humans and chimps, where we recirculate small quantities of vitamin C. And the distinction is this: these animals that manufacture their own vitamin C manufacture huge quantities of it and basically just flood their bodies with like 20 to 30,000 international units of vitamin C. And given that we humans are designed to live 70, 80, 90 years, that much vitamin C being manufactured by our bodies would have a damaging effect, especially on our brains. And so, I mean, it was Linus Pauling who was really encouraging us to take lots of vitamin C. And now we recognize that taking too much vitamin C can be an issue. What it actually does in the human brain is it causes minor bleeding in the small capillaries in the brain. Not a problem if you're consuming lots of vitamin C for short periods of time, but if you're doing it for all your life, yes, it's going to eventually cause noticeable damage to your brain. Instead, our bodies are designed where we take the vitamin C that we consume and very efficiently recycle that vitamin C, keeping at a level that's optimal for functioning so that we can maintain a healthy brain for 70, 80, 90 years. And so that's the debate we've been having with our friends at BioLogos, is basically saying, if you actually look at the design feature in chimpanzees and humans, it's an extremely complex, far more complicated than the manufacture of vitamin C, this system of recycling small amounts of vitamin C. So given that that's in our diet, we're fine. Now, the big question is, how come guinea pigs can't manufacture their vitamin C? And you know, that's still an unsolved issue, exactly why they would have that need, because after all, they don't live long, so we really see no need for it. Although I've read some articles where they say God did this on purpose, so we would have these animals, which would make a very good human model, and it is true. We use guinea pigs for medical research, and that wouldn't happen if they didn't have that shared feature with us. So that, of course, that's where we got the term guinea pig from, is that here's a little small creature that amazingly shares with us the same thing we share with the apes. And guinea pigs are a lot easier to work with in medical research than a chimpanzee. They don't get angry and beat you up like a chimpanzee will. Okay, any other questions, comments? Again, I'll look for your hand, but the easiest way is just to unmute your microphone. Let me see what's in the chat thing here.
I'll try another question if no one has one.
Okay.
Here's something that makes us exceptional, and that's our ability to sin.
Very good point. And you don't really see that being addressed in the scientific literature. We humans don't like to admit that we're sinners, especially if we don't have a relationship with God. But yes, that is a unique feature. And where that debate's been coming up, and I've actually written some articles on reasons.org on altruism, and basically saying the way to understand altruism is to put it in the context of what you suggested, Ross, is that we humans are actually spiteful. Is that we don't see spite in the non-human animals. And what I mean by spite is where you do harm to another individual where there's no benefit to you. I mean, there's no advantage. I mean, stealing food, I mean, you do see that in the animal kingdom where they'll steal a nest or they'll steal food, but it's because they benefit from that robbing of the food or the nest. But we see with humans, is that we will do harm to one another where it's actually counter to our best interests. I mean, we see this, for example, with despots like Joe Stalin and Adolf Hitler, where they did very spiteful things that were actually harmful to them as individuals. They'd be better off not doing the spite that they did. I mean, a good example is you've got Joe Stalin killing off his best officers in his military forces, which caused them to almost be overrun by the Nazis in World War II. And so here he was, out of his paranoia and spite, killing 20 million fellow Russians. And those 20 million Russians he killed basically lowered his population level where they weren't able to field the army that would have been very helpful to bring a shorter end to World War II And yeah, when the Nazis invaded, he didn't have skilled officers. He killed them all off.
Animals don't get paranoid.
Well, I mean, probably an example you hear is Mao Zedong, who killed off all the intellectuals in China and basically put Chinese economy, it held them back for decades, all the people he had killed off. But this is unique to us human beings. And this is something you see in the writings of, who's that French philosopher who wrote the Pensées? I'm trying to think of his name. Pascal. Yeah, Pascal wrote a book where he made the point, as a scientist, as a Christian, what's really different about us humans compared to all other non-human life is that we are altruistic to a degree you never see outside of the human species, and we're wicked and spiteful to a degree you don't see. And so we're paradoxically virtuous and paradoxically wretched. And so, again, thank you, Ross. That's a great point, often overlooked. And so that's another big debate, because people claim, well, animals are altruistic. Well, they're certainly altruistic when they're bonded to us. A horse will sacrifice his life to save its human owner, for example. And often you'll see, of course, with the soulish animals, the parents will sacrifice in order to care for their offspring. What we're seeing with humans is that they will perform a major sacrifice for their enemies. And so this is unique to human beings, where we will do things where there's no traceable benefit whatsoever. Only we humans will actually say, give up our life in order to benefit our enemies. But likewise, we do things where we're spiteful even to those people that are meeting our needs and are close to us. I mean, this is what destroys families and marriages, for example. We are spiteful towards those we love. And that's because we are sinners. Incidentally, there's a major debate going on within Christianity over the issue of original sin, where people claim that sin is something that evolved in us. It wasn't there from the beginning. But I take the position it really was there from the time of Adam and Eve. Okay, we got the, yes, go ahead, Yvonne.
I have a question regarding the fossil records. Some of my atheist friends, what question they have raised is that, so now we see the fossil records for the, for example, for the amphibians and also the land animals, right? So there is no intermediate fossil records to show or to prove that evolution is really true. But the question that the atheists raise is that, have we already digged up all the fossil records? So we cannot make that conclusion. So,
yeah, I think it just came out on my Today's New Reason to Believe. I put up a post. I think it's already up. If it's not, it'll be up this Monday. Basically making the point that when you look at the fossil record and compare it with the molecular clocks you get from looking at the genes, there's always a disconnect. And if we're looking at a naturalistic explanation of the origin of life, you'd expect that the history of life we develop from the genetics, the molecular clocks, would be consistent with a fossil record, and they're not. The fossil record documents way more extinctions than what we see in the genetics. And when I talk about them being out of sync, sometimes they're out of sync by a quarter of a billion years. For example, an attempt to try to trace the ancestry of the Cambrian explosion animals, predicts a date for the origin that's literally a quarter of a billion years out of sync with the actual fossils. The point you're raising, and I've heard it raised by many non-theistic paleoanthropologists, is that the fossil record is incomplete. And therefore, these transitional forms that we need to explain our model, we simply haven't found them yet. There's a number of articles, and again, Fuzz has written articles at reasons.org pointing this out, is that the fossil record, yes, is not complete, but it's complete enough. You could argue that it's at least 2% complete, and was 2% complete. I think it's more complete than that, but even if it's only 2% complete, we should be seeing these transitions. And we're not seeing them. The article Spuzz has written says, when we do see the claim transitions, they're not at the right time. I mean, for example, there's this idea that fish came into the shores and evolved into becoming tetrapods where they could walk on the land. And then they show this fossil of this fish that exists near the shore that has a capability of going on land for short periods. The problem is you've got tetrapods that only live in the land that predate those animals. And so it's like you've got this transitional form showing up later rather than earlier in the fossil record. And we see numerous examples where it's at a sink. And Buzz's argument, and I agree with him, is what we see today. We see these same kinds of transitions. We do see animals at the seashore that got the capability of going on the land and going back to the ocean. There's an advantage to having those kinds of capabilities. And we see those animals existing for hundreds of millions of years. They're not a transition. There's simply a species created to take advantage of that particular environmental niche. But again, you see these creatures that look like they're half bird and half mammal, like the platypus. But again, it's designed for a unique situation. But I think the strongest argument against the naturalistic idea is that these claimed transitional forms show up at the wrong time. They're not in the sequence you'd expect. Moreover, I was at a conference with the BioLogos scholars where they made a big deal about all the transitional forms we see with the whales and tried to claim that there was this naturalistic whale evolution that went on for 50, 60 million years. But they failed to take into account that whales are mammals. They have huge body sizes. They have a limited number of offspring per adult. Their populations are relatively low. And so from an evolutionary perspective, they have a very low probability of evolving with respect to time. And yet we see about 60 different transitions in the history of whales. Moreover, something I'm pointing out in the new book I got coming out, Weathering Climate Change, is that what you see with the whales is that these different species actually show up at the right time and the right place to help compensate for the brightening of the sun. So from a biblical perspective, we got a God that knows the future physics of the sun, knows how the sun is getting brighter and brighter as it gets older and older, and creates just the right species at just the right time and just the right places and numbers in order to be able to alter the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to compensate for the brightening of the sun, maintaining optimal conditions. And whales play a big role in that. And whales, because of their huge body sizes and small populations, are guaranteed to go extinct before they can evolve. Several papers have been published making that point. Any mammal species with a body size bigger than 3 kilograms will go extinct before it evolves. But a point I've made is God loves whales and he's wanting to compensate for the brightening of the sun. So every time a whale species goes extinct, he makes a new one. But the idea that the old one evolved into the new one by naturalistic process simply doesn't take into account the extreme limitations that whales have for naturalistic evolution. But that point comes up all the time. So thanks for raising that. Okay, we got Doug asking a question. By the way, seems like three of you are dominating the Q&A. The rest of you want to jump in, feel free.
But go. Sorry, you don't have to acknowledge me. I'm raising my hand. So. But anyway, also that I think the fact that there are balanced ecosystems and all these different animals have a balanced relationship. If like predators die, non-predators die also, and things like that. That really throws a real wrench into the gears, I think, when you're trying to say that everything just randomly evolved or natural selection has no intelligence or anything like that.
Yeah, again, that's a point my colleague Fazal Rana has made repeatedly, is that when you see these mass extinction events, followed by mass speciation events. With a mass speciation event, you get optimal ecological relationships immediately. From a naturalistic perspective, you would expect it would take tens of millions of years for the ecological relationships between predators and prey and the parasites and the detritivores to optimize. What we see is after every major extinction event, we get a mass speciation event where the ecological relationships are optimized right away. There's not this long delay. So we see that the predators are able, for example, to kill and feed upon the injured, the weak, the sick, the dying, and therefore enhance the viability of the herbivores that they're feeding on. Whereas from an evolutionary perspective, a naturalistic perspective, you'd expect that, for example, there would be times when the predators have so much an advantage, they're killing off all the healthy ones, or they're not able to kill any at all, in which case the herbivores wind up getting disease. But it's optimized right away. And you can make the same argument for the parasites and the detritivores. Detritivores, if you're not familiar with that term, are life forms of process dead plants and animals. And yeah, you need these creatures to be efficiently processing the dead in order to maintain a healthy ecosystem. Okay, anyone else?
There's a question in the chat.
Okay, we got another raised hand from Ross. Go for it, Ross.
I was watching a video this week, and I don't remember who it was, but they said that the fossil record is actually really bad evidence for evolution because it requires so many ad hoc explanations to make it work. I thought that was a very interesting way to see it. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, that's in the article that's going to be posted at reasons.org under today's new reason to believe. But we see in the fossil record is it documents that we have a very high extinction rate. And, you know, we have a high extinction rate today, but the scientific literature is saying it's not unique just to our time. The extinction rate, according to the fossil record, has always been high. But if you got a high extinction rate, in order to maintain a balance of life on planet Earth, you need an equally high speciation rate. And required speciation rate is just way too high to be explained by pure naturalism. And incidentally, I'm not saying you can't get new species by pure naturalism. You can, but it's very limited. In order to explain why you see an increasing diversity and an increasing abundance of life on planet Earth, you need aggressive supernatural intervention. And my argument has always been that intervention is always designed with the physics of the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun in mind. And only a mind that knows the future physics of the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun is going to know what new species to create and what old species to remove. And I would argue you actually see this in the Bible, Psalm 104, verses 29 and 30. It's a property of all life to die off, but God recreates and renews the face of the earth. So this is actually not only just a scientific observation, it's something that's recorded in the Bible thousands of years ago.
Thank you.
Okay, Doug, you got another question?
Yeah, I can pause and wait if somebody is just shy or hasn't figured out how to ask questions yet. But you mentioned extinction events. I'm sorry, but I have to ask this. What do you say when some people think that this coronavirus could be an extinction event? Because, you know, the Bible says it doesn't, right? It won't be.
Well, I've got two articles coming out on COVID-19. One will come out tomorrow. So yeah, if you go to reasons.org and today's new reason to believe, you'll see my article. And I got one coming out the following Monday as well. The one I got coming out tomorrow basically addresses your question. Is this virus a fulfillment of end times prophecy, particularly what we see in Revelation 6, where it talks about those days before the return of Jesus Christ, when there'll be pestilence raging throughout the world. And basically talks about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, a combination of war and famine and disease, wiping out a quarter of the world's population. And I'm basically making the point that all the projections, even the very dire predictions of this COVID-19, is that the kill rate's going to be far below that. In fact, even the worst projections are saying it's not even going to come close to equaling the kill rate that we saw with the Spanish flu in 1918 and 1919. And I also make the point in the article coming out tomorrow is that just based on what we know about viruses and how humans engage with animals and the world, we would expect to see something like the Spanish flu occurring about once every century or two. In fact, if you look at the past several thousand years, that's how frequently we've had a major viral outbreak. And the one we're experiencing now looks like it's going to be minor compared to those. Now, when I say minor, we've got, you know, 7.8 billion people on the face of the earth, and they're jammed closely together. So even though this is not going to have the same percentage kill rate as the Spanish flu, it's still going to be a devastating impact on our culture today. And then the one I got coming up the following Monday basically addresses a very common question I've been getting about why would an all-powerful, all-good God create a world with viruses? And so in that one, I'm going to talk about all the benefits we get from viruses and how human sin makes viruses far worse than God ever intended. And I think we can blame this coronavirus on the way we humans have not really obeyed God's command to manage the planet for our benefit and the benefit of all life. So it's sin that causes the really bad virus. And you look at the bad viruses, SARS, HIV, and this COVID-19, you look at Ebola, these are all viral diseases that were caused by human abuse. And so it's kind of like the mosquitoes. God created mosquitoes for a very good purpose, but limited them to 10% of the planet's surface area. Because of human abuse, they now occupy 99% of the land area, and they're now a nuisance and a threat to our health. But God never intended to be that way. So those two articles will be coming out. And incidentally, our team at Reasons to Believe is actually going to be coming out with about a dozen different articles, not just on COVID-19, but on viruses in general and how they fit into a biblical creation model. So you can look for that. Okay, I see another hand there. Let me get my glasses on so I can recognize it.
It's Mark.
Ah, Mark, yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I saw in the news this week something about a new push for money and resources for fusion energy. Did you hear anything about that?
Yes, I have. And if you recall, about a couple of months ago, I gave a talk on paradoxes on thorium reactors, basically making the point that, we've spent 70 years trying to find a way for controlled fusion energy. And realizing, I think, after many decades of a lot of money and research being spent, is that we're not going to get very far, because controlled fusion means that we have to have magnetic bottles that are really stable and relatively big. And I'm not saying we will never get controlled fusion, but I am saying is that the technology and the money needed to make it happen is going to be a lot more than what could be done with thorium. Thorium is a proven technology, and you're not going to have the radioactive waste you're going to get with the nuclear fusion or with uranium fission. And so I think that's up on the paradoxes.org site. So if people want to get a recording of that, they can. But yeah, I think there's better ways we can channel our energy money than into nuclear fusion.
Thank you.
I have a comment about the recent virus panic.
Yeah, go for it.
Yes, I noticed that the latest reports, I even saw a graphical presentation, show that the new case rate is drastically declining in China and in South Korea. And both the Chinese and the South Koreans are using high doses of vitamin C as part of the therapy. A lot of people say, well, you can't trust China, but I think you can reasonably rely on South Koreans. They report the staff using vitamin C seldom come down with symptoms, and if they do, they're mild and brief. They find that some of the people with very serious respiratory distress receiving the vitamin C intravenously recover rapidly and are able to be discharged from the hospital. It's I regard it as a scandal that that kind of therapy is not more widespread, and why it has been just consistently ignored in the American medical system. But the main thing is that if that protocol, that treatment mode had been implemented, that this whole drastic, costly situation of a panic could have been completely avoided.
Well, it's a good comment, John, and yeah, that's something that people are wondering about. It's not just South Korea and China. It seems all over Asia. I mean, for example, why is the COVID virus situation look so much better in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, and China? And yeah, if they're all using large doses of vitamin C, that might explain why they're faring better than Western Europe and the United States. And as I said earlier, you don't want to overdose with vitamin C throughout your life. It's going to have an effect on your organs, especially your brain. But for a short period of time, it shouldn't be an issue. So, and I don't know what the dosage is that they're using in China and South Korea, or whether or not that's actually something that's happening in the rest of the Asian nations. But it's something that people have pointed out. The one pushback I've seen in that is, I said, well, you got to be careful because Asia had the virus first. And maybe what's happening is they're all on the downhill part of a viral outbreak, whereas Western Europe and the U.S. and Canada is on the upswing. But there may be more to it than that. So, yeah, I'd be interested as to whether that is a feature of treatment that's throughout all of Asia, or whether it's just South Korea and China. But Japan, for example, has remarkably good numbers given their population and the density of their population. So, yeah, it's like, you know, what are they doing there? And some other researchers have been pointing out, too, is that what you see in Asia is a much lower obesity rate than you see in Western Europe and the U.S. And so they've been saying, you know, we need to look at the stats and see if obesity is a factor and whether or not people succumb to the virus. So there's a lot more we can learn about this. And, you know, I just think we need to be careful about what we think, but there could be multiple factors. Maybe it's a combination of the sedentary lifestyle, obesity, and the lack of vitamin C. Who knows? But yeah, a lot of people pointed out is that things seem to be looking a lot more favorable in Asia than they do in Western Europe and North America. So yeah, there needs to be some further research, what's going on. And yes, the figures in China might be altered. It means a lot of people suspicious that things aren't going as well there as what the Chinese authorities tell us. But I think we can trust what's happening in Japan and Taiwan and South Korea.
Well, to fill in about the dosing, in the medical people in South Korea and China report they're using 10 to 20 grams intravenously infused at a gradual rate. And also there's other things for the immune system that make a huge difference. So the virus will never produce symptoms, so take effect. The other one is vitamin D. Most people are deficient in vitamin D because we don't get the sunlight we did a century ago, being outdoors and so forth. And people that are taking 5,000 units or more a day of vitamin D with making sure they eat it with a meal with fat also have a increased immunity. And that's the real secret, is the boosting the immune system. And also in Asia, they are using of methods to sterilize the environment, and the people are taking precautions in when they're out in groups and so forth, and that also is reducing the rate of transmission. Of course, we may slow it in the United States by the current program, so to speak, but we'll probably have a more extended situation with new cases based on the way things are being treated in the United States. But again, if it was part of the medical practice to use this vitamin C on a short-term basis, the whole mortality rate could be lower than the seasonal flu.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know they were using that heavy of a dose. I mean, 10 to 20, that's a lot. And it'd be interesting to see if that could be done with a lower dose, because you don't want to sustain that for too long.
No, it's temporary during a therapeutic situation. And they also, the Chinese are doing a 400 subject, a triple blind study of using vitamin C versus other, versus a placebo. They're publishing in September. That's got to be a while. But in the initial reports from medical directors is that they're getting very significant results. So that's sort of a preview. It'll be interesting to know, to see whether the results of the triple blind study are continue to be ignored as being a viable mode of treatment. Now, for the people that are not yet infected, they take lower doses, something like I think about 2 grams a day is probably adequate, and it's, especially if it's divided up and taken throughout the day in small increments, or using liposomal form, which is also much more effective.
Yeah, and I'm guessing too that in Asia they don't have college students partying in spring break in close quarters like they do here in the U.S. So there's a lifestyle issue. I think one of the benefits are going to accrue from this coronavirus is people are going to realize, you know, there's a wiser way in which we can live and, you know, develop our health. But at this point, there's viruses are viruses. It's something I got in my article coming up today and the next week is that it's really hard to predict what viruses will do. I mean, the big risk with this virus is it may last long enough that it mutates where people get sick twice. That's what happened with the Spanish flu. So, but this gives us an opportunity to figure out, okay, what really are the risk factors? Is it, you know, vitamins? Is it, you know, lifestyle? Is it obesity? Is it the fact that, you know, we like to be in outdoor restaurants close together? We're not very good at practicing social distancing. People said maybe the reason why it's so high in Spain is that people kiss one another a lot. That could be a factor. There could be other factors. I think, you know, this is kind of a time where we can actually begin to do some of these double-blind studies and see what's working and what's not working. But it's interesting that it looks like this vitamin C might be a factor. I hope it doesn't cause a run on like it did on toilet paper. So we'll see. Okay, it's 12:12 right now. So I'll take one last question. And if there are no questions, I'll stop the recording. And the recording will get posted at paradoxes.org. You know, if it's not posted right away, just give us some time. We're still kind of trying to work out the details. But yeah, this has been recorded in the cloud. We'll bring it down from the cloud and put it on paradoxes.org. We'll let you know if it's available elsewhere as well. Let me close our time out in prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for being alive in the 21st century, or even where we got this major health crisis raging throughout the world. We can still meet together. We can still congregate and worship you and look at what you've revealed in both the book of scripture and the book of nature. And Father, I pray that even though many of us are in their lockdown, that you find ways for us to communicate. And I thank you, Lord, for our team at Reasons to Believe, which is going to launch several new social media communication and YouTube opportunities starting this week. And Father, I pray that you would bless that effort and that people be encouraged and strengthened and that people would go to you, Lord, during this time of unrest and lack of hope and people being frightened. And Father, I pray that their fears would be quelled and they'd be comforted by you. And Father, I pray too that this would be a time when we would really reach out and help those that need help. Lord, this is a time when we can demonstrate service to one another. So guide and direct us in that way, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, well, thank all of you for participating. And looks like we still have some more open slots. So next week we'll meet again. And if we ever get to the point where we need more than 100, we'll try to get that set up. So I'm going to stop the recording at this point. And I got control over this, so I'm going to actually shut everybody down. And we'll get together next week.